While she was visiting San Quentin Prison on assignment for NPR, Nancy Mullane was put in a small, unguarded room with four convicted murderers. At the time, her impression was that these men were kept behind bars to prevent them from killing again, but she was convinced otherwise by her experience during those fateful 15 minutes with the four felons and years of subsequent reporting that that experience inspired have led her to write a book called Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption, which sheds lights on parole laws and examines what life is like for someone after they've committed the most heinous of all crimes. It is published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it brings Nancy Mullane to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You open your book with the scene that I've just described. Were you told to wait in this small holding room at San Quentin unsupervised with four convicted murderers for any reason? I mean, why would they do that?
Well, you know, that's not quite the way it happened, but, you know, it did happen. And what happened was I was asked to do a story for National Public Radio about prisons in California. It's a $10 billion a year industry. And I thought rather than talk to academics, and I would go inside the prison and find out what was going on inside the local prison, which was San Quentin State Prison, about 20 minutes north of San Francisco. And the first time I went in, the public information officer led me through the Sally Port. And then his phone, he got a phone call. And he said, I have to go take care of this somewhere else in the prison. I'll just leave you in this little room over here. And I thought he locked the door, but he hadn't. And that's when the door opened and four men came in who were serving life sentences for murder.
And did you know that they were serving life sentences for murder?
Well, they had blues on, blue shirt, blue jeans. That meant they'd been there for a while. And in my mind, that meant they probably committed the worst crime. And in fact, they had committed murder. But I thought people are kept behind prison walls. It was kind of a stereotypical idea in my mind. I don't know where I got it, that if someone's behind prison and they've committed a murder, that given the opportunity in a room, they want to do it again. That's why we have to keep them in prison. But in fact, you know, after 15 minutes, I kept my eyes averted, thinking if you don't look at them, they won't be engaged. It won't incite them. And I looked down and then one of them reached out his hand and said, I'm Don Kronk. Who are you? Mm-hmm. And instead of, you know, and I think that moment, you know, kind of began swirling. And that question began of who are people who have committed a murder, you know, after they've been sentenced, after we've put them on a bus and they've gone behind that prison wall with a sentence of life with the possibility of parole, who are they at the other end of that sentence 20, 30 years later?
Lieutenant Eric Messick, San Quentin's public information officer, wasn't worried about your safety. Did he believe these men weren't dangerous, or did he simply not realize that he'd put you in a room with some convicted murderers?
Well, when he put me in the room was empty. So I think he thought maybe, but that these men wouldn't come in, that I would just be all right, I assume. But later I spoke with him when I wrote the book, and I described the fact that, you know, Eric, I'm Lieutenant Messick, I'm going to put this in the book. And he said, well, you know, Nancy, I knew you were going to be all right. And I said, but at that moment, I didn't. And I was afraid. But in a way, that moment propelled something else.
But you'd also had other reasons to be afraid. Before you were given clearance to enter San Quentin, Lieutenant Messick told you not to expect the warden to trade you for a prisoner if you were taken hostage.
That's true.
That's kind of
scary.
They do
warn you that before you go in.
And they also told you not to wear blue jeans because that would suggest that you were a long-term prisoner?
You can't wear anything blue when you go inside a prison because the prisoners wear blue. Mm-hmm. So you are expected to wear any other color. There are certain things you can't wear, but blue is definitely one of them.
You say that the reason you've never met a murderer before is that from the moment they're arrested until they're released from prison, inmates are locked away invisible, and that anonymity provides them a little comfort, especially after they reenter outside life. Why do you think these men agreed to talk with you?
I think that day was one of those moments that happened that can't be planned. It was a moment that probably changed their lives. I know it changed my life. Because I realized that as a reporter, our job is to go into places where no one else can go. And obviously, the public cannot just walk into a prison and do a story and see what's going on. And that's our job. And so I was sitting in that room having direct access to these men who had committed this worst crime. And it was in that contact, it was in that experience that I realized I had never met anyone who had committed a murder. But then did I know anyone who had ever met someone who had committed a murder on the outside? And, you know, that's kind of what propelled, as I mentioned before, propelled this work, because I realized if I didn't know, then that was something many probably didn't know. So I began asking that question, who are people who commit a murder at the other end? And I realized that when we send people into prison, we want them punished for what they have done. But in our laws, we also sentence them to life with the possibility of parole if they do everything we ask them to do. And I didn't even know what that thing that we want them to do looks like after they've committed a murder. And can someone come back from that kind of a crime?
How were these five men selected? Were they selected by prison officials, or did you talk to a whole bunch of people and pick these five?
I ended up going, returning to San Quentin over and over again, doing another story and another story. Because in California, as in many prisons, if you go inside the prison as a reporter, you cannot ask to speak to an inmate by their name. So in order to follow up on any of the individuals that I met on any particular story, I had to continue going in and have random access. But as I would go in, I would say, oh, I think that one prisoner is over there. So I said, can we just stop by the chapel, or can we go over to the work environment? And I would have these repeat experiences where I would be able to follow up on their stories.
And why don't they want you to be able to request a prisoner? Because then you might get involved with trying to get them released?
No, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation has explained that it's a policy that was put into effect in 1996, and they feel that it prohibits reporters from sensationalizing any particular inmate, but it also prevents reporters from actually having interviews with inmates who are either, you know, have a case, or they're filing a lawsuit, or they have a real story.
Because it would be interesting to be able to request a time with Charles Manson, for example, or Phil Spector.
Could be.
You say one of the men you talked to, Eddie Ramirez, was a little hesitant to talk with you because it was a risk. What kind of risk was it?
Well, these individuals, the five men in the book, and I've now interviewed more than 100 men and women inside prisons in the state of California who have been convicted of murder and been given life with the possibility of parole. And the way they've explained it to me, and you know, is when they're concerned that the media is going to present them in kind of a locked up profile, that they're not really going to get to their stories and who they've really become or what they're really doing behind the walls. And so I ended up doing a number of stories in which I actually told those stories, and the wardens in four prisons respected my work. The California Department of Corrections and the state capitol listened to my work, and the inmates had radios, and they listened. And so they said, you know, you're not burning us. You're not sensationalizing our stories. You're actually telling our stories. And so as a result of that, they gave me access to continued to be interviewed. And one of the interesting things is in California, if you're given a life with parole, and you do all of your time, so 25 years on a first degree, 15 years on a second degree, and then you begin going before the parole board, which is appointed by the governor, approved by the state senate. And if the commissioners on the parole board find you suitable for parole, in California, Maryland, and Oklahoma in the United States, there's another layer, and it's the governor of the state, 150 days later, has the authority to reverse that.
My guest is Nancy Mullane, who develops reports and produces feature stories for Public Radio International's This American Life, also National Public Radio and the NPR affiliate KALW in San Francisco. Her book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption, is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's talk about what you just brought up. It's the result of Proposition 89.
That's correct. In 1988, the voters of California passed a law. It's called Proposition 89. And what that law gave the governor of the state was the authority to, if someone is found suitable for parole on a murder conviction in the state of California, it gives the governor the authority 150 days later to reverse that parole decision.
And why was that even brought up as a proposition for the public to vote on?
It's a great question. And if you remember, back in 1988, there was a man named Willie Horton. And Willie Horton was serving a life without the possibility of parole. So he was never going to get out of prison. And he was sentenced in the state of Massachusetts. But in Massachusetts, and in fact, 1988, you'll remember, was, like now, a presidential election year. And Michael Dukakis was the governor of Massachusetts, running as a Democrat in the presidential election against George Bush, the father. And he was the vice president, running as an incumbent vice president. And the Republican Party discovered there was this man named Willie Horton. And while Michael Dukakis was governor of Massachusetts, a law had been passed that he did not pass, but this law was passed that gave anyone serving a life without the possibility of parole sentence in that state a weekend furlough. That means they could leave on a Friday, come back on a Monday. Well, this man, Willie Horton, was released on a Friday, and he never came back. He went back, stole a car, drove to Maryland, raped a woman, and beat up her boyfriend. He was sentenced and convicted in Maryland for that crime and never returned to Massachusetts. But the Republican Party, in this election year, discovered this situation. And so Willie Horton became a rallying cry, a national rallying cry to hold the governors of your state accountable for what happens. So the voters of California passed a law, Proposition 89, and that gave the governor that authority to reverse. Now, even before that law was passed, we know from the California Department of Corrections that anyone who was doing time for a murder conviction had the lowest recidivism rate of all categories of crime.
On average,
and still, we passed the law.
On average, how much time did a murderer spend in jail before 1977?
I believe it was about 18 months. 30 months. It was much shorter time. Months and years get confused, but it was about 10 years.
So a murderer would, unless it was a celebrated crime, with good behavior, might get out after 10 years?
Yes. In fact,
which probably outraged some family members of the victims.
There really wasn't that much of an outcry because they had such a low recidivism rate. Individuals who had committed murder and gotten out of prison, they went before the parole board. They weren't always found suitable for parole. But once they were released once they were found suitable, and only about 15% were found suitable each year that went before the parole board, even before the governor was given that authority, they were released on parole, and they did not come back. So there wasn't, in fact, there wasn't that much of an outcry at that time.
Is there any theory as to why there's a high recidivism rate in so many other kinds of criminal activity, not murder? Is it because murder is it generally an impulse crime?
Well, I think one of the things we know about the individuals who are serving sentences for murder is it happens between the ages of 17 and 24. 90% are usually under the influence of alcohol or drugs at the time of the conviction or at the time of the crime occurs. And, I think when someone's on drinking or on drugs, their impulses are impacted, and so they do these impulse crimes, and then immediately after the crime, what we've found is there is a sense of deep remorse, but we don't know really what that looks like, because once they're sent into jail and then they're gone to trial and they're convicted and they're sent behind the prison walls, we really don't see that. So one of the things that we're looking at in California is we have two kinds of sentences. We have a life sentence with the possibility of parole, and that's only for murder. All other sentences in the state of California are a determinate sentence. That means at the time of your conviction, you are sentenced to a set time. So for rape, it's 2 years for the first offense, but you get out in half time, so that's 1 year. Those individuals on that kind of a conviction, of a determinate conviction, usually have a 65 to 70% recidivism rate, whereas the individuals who are serving life sentences with the possibility of parole who go before the parole board and then go before the governor, they have had this extended period of time in prison. And in fact, they actually run the prisons in the state. They do the plumbing. They do the electrical work. They have eight-hour-a-day jobs in prison. And knowing that that parole board is at the end of that line, they know that if they have one disciplinary write-up, if they even smoke a cigarette in prison, which is illegal, it's called a 116. It's a disciplinary write-up. And that can be enough in California to prohibit them from getting parole.
So these guys live exemplary lives as best they can in that very violent world that they live in. Or are they kind of kept out of the violent world that we hear so much about?
Well, I think, you know, inside North Block, inside San Quentin's North Block, which is the cell block of 500 cells where the lifer community lives. I've been in there a number of times. And, you know, these individuals, many of them are old. You know, the average age of an inmate is now around 45. So these men are, you know, and because of Governor Review, what we've now discovered and what no one seemed to have been watching was what was the impact of Governor Review on parole board decisions. What we've discovered now is that in 22 years since the governor was given that authority, the governors, four different governors, have reversed between 75 and 99% of all those found suitable. So these are men who continue to do what they need to do what we as a society have asked them to do. And yet when they go before the parole board and are found suitable, and then the governor reverses, it's really a devastating situation. So they really have formed a community within North Block to support one another.
My guest is Nancy Mullane, Mullane. Her book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption, published by Public Affairs. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Nancy Mullane, who's written a book called Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. It's published by Public Affairs. And all five men that you interviewed were approved for parole by the state board. And then the governor, the same governor, overturned each recommendation?
Well, there were two different governors involved.
Doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat or a Republican?
It didn't. It really didn't matter. I was kind of surprised by that. Governor Gray Davis came into office, and when he was he said, no murderer will be released from the prison under my watch unless they're in a pine box. He, in the 6 years that he was in office, he released 13. And prior to that, there were somewhere between 100 and 200 released each year in the state of California. There are 25,000 individuals now in the state of California serving life with the possibility for parole. And at the time the law went into effect, it was about 4,000.
Has anyone done a study as to why a few have been granted parole and so many others have been denied it?
A study on the parole board's process?
Well, the parole board goes through the process and then they decide, okay, this person is suitable for parole. And then 150 days later, the governor says, no, most of the time. Yes, once in a while. Do we know why yes in a couple of cases and no so many other times?
Well, that's a very good question. I interviewed two of the legal affairs secretaries for two different governors. And the legal affairs secretaries told me they had different processes. So Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, he reversed 75% of the time, whereas Gray Davis reversed 99%. So I thought, what's the difference between the two processes? And what Governor Gray Davis was pretty much just reverse everyone. And Governor Schwarzenegger came in, and I interviewed Peter Siggins, his legal affairs secretary. I said, how did you make these decisions? A, they never met directly with a person who was found suitable for parole after they'd been convicted. So they were never brought to the governor's office. They would sit down with a file. They had 30 days because what happens actually is the person's found suitable for parole. Then the parole, their whole file goes to Sacramento, the state capitol. And the parole board has 120 days or 4 months to go through all of the details of their crime, what they've done in prison. And at the end of the 120 days, if they have been proven to have a full-time job on the outside, which is one of the criteria for parole, they have to have a safe place to live. So they have to. The parole agent will go to their house. They'll check out the job. If that is all cleared at the end of the 120 days, then the file goes to the governor. And then the governor begins the 30 days. And they said so they would, the legal affairs office would make a recommendation to the governor, and the governor would then, in the end, make his own decision. That process has actually changed since Governor Jerry Brown came in for his second stint as governor of the state. And since he came to office, he has begun reversing only 17%. So he is allowing 80% of those found suitable to be released from prison.
Is this going to come back to haunt him?
It doesn't seem to be. That's an interesting situation. There hasn't been.
I'm sure that's what the others, Gray Davis, who had a reputation for being a liberal, I'm afraid he was looking very much at what happened to Michael Dukakis. You've given your book the title Life After Murder, yet you also provide some information about these inmates' lives before they committed their crimes. Mm. Richie says that he can trace his life and crime back to an injury his father sustained that prevented him from working, and that made money tight within the family. It changed their social circumstances, and that led him to criminal activity, but, you know, I can understand stealing if you're hungry. How is murder ever justified?
I don't think that the men that I have profiled are asking for us to believe that there's any justification for what they have done. And I think that's what's important about the book, is we're not looking at individuals who are saying, I didn't do it. These are men who have gotten out of prison and are saying, I did it. This is what someone who's committed a murder 20, 30 years ago, this is what we look like on the outside. We, you know, and I think that that's something we don't know. We don't know what people, because when someone's in prison for a murder offense and they are found suitable for parole and they get out of prison, they fade back into society. They don't want, you know, they're I think we're all afraid of people who commit a murder. So they tend to just come back. And, you know, what I found out was the Bureau of Justice Statistics in Washington, I called and said, and I spoke to a statistician there. I said, how many people who have committed a murder one, murder two offense actually get out of prison in the United States? And he said, I don't know, exclusive murder one, murder two. So we did the calculations. And what we found was that in 10 years, in state and federal prisons, 57,000 individuals convicted exclusively of first or second degree murder have been released from prisons in 10 years with the lowest recidivism rate.
Now, California has a major overpopulation because of its three strikes law, and we just received a call from a listener whose brother spent 22 years in prison for a nonviolent crime because of the three strikes law. When he was released from prison, he was given very little support, this man writes.
Mm-hmm.
Did any of the men you spoke with make you aware of programs where convicted felons can go for support after they're released into the mainstream society? Of course, none of these men actually were released, which is part of the story you're telling.
Yes. But, well, the men that I profile have all been released. I'll give away the book's
eventually.
Story. Yes. They have all been released eventually. And two of them, a governor said, I'm going to let you out. In fact, it was Governor Schwarzenegger. They were released under Governor Schwarzenegger's oversight. And three of them were reversed. And then they began an appeals process in the state court. And that was a process that I found really interesting, because when they began appealing governor reversals, it finally made its way up to the California Supreme Court in 2008. And the California Supreme Court, for the first time since the law was passed, overruled the governor and said, you know, you're reversing and saying we're not going to let you out because of the original crime. But that's a condition you can never change. And if we give you life with the possibility of parole and then we say no because of your original crime, well, they'll never get out. So it was called the Lawrence decision. And that began individuals who had been found suitable and been reversed by the governor on original crime were getting out of prison. And so they, on the outside, I kind of began following them on the outside to find out what their lives were like. Is this redemption inside and this rehabilitation? What does it look like on the outside? And, you know, they get out with $200 after 25, 30 years in prison. And that's it, $200.
And after having lived in a teeny cell, you had the opportunity to see inside of a San Quentin inmate's cell.
And I actually took a measuring tape.
You say that both the federal rules and the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals would say that the cell area is too small to confine one dog.
Well, that was what one of the inmates told me, that they are extremely small. They're about the size of a walk-in closet, not even quite the size of a walk-in closet.
And two men live in them?
Two men live in these cells. And if there's a lockdown, the lockdowns can happen. They can last, and they never know. In the morning, there could be a lockdown that morning, and they can last for 2-3 months where they are in that cell with another man. And, you know, the cells are so small that if you stand with your shoulder to the edge of one of the bunks, your other shoulder hits the wall. So you have to turn to the side. And I actually asked them to let me sit inside a cell. Let me be in there to feel what it feels like. And this was, of course, with the public information officer outside and the inmates. And I sat inside the cell, and I noticed that when you sit on the lower bunk, that you couldn't sit up straight. So there's no place, unless you sit on the floor, there's nowhere you can sit up. Because the bunk hits the back of your neck or the ceiling. There's two bunks. So you just get a sense of the size of this environment.
Some of these, the guy who first introduced himself to you, Don Kronk, seems to have gotten almost a raw deal. In another case, Eddie Ramirez strikes me as somebody who was almost proud of some of the things he did. And Richie told you life immediately after someone commits murder doesn't sound too tough. He told you that after he was released on bail, he went back to work, kept the same routine as before the crime, and continued to drink and do drugs. He even smoked a joint while he was on lunch break during the last day of the jury deliberations.
This is
so
true.
I guess it's 20 years later that it takes 20 years for them to fully figure out what went wrong in their lives.
I'm not the person who determined. I can't tell at 10 or 5 or 7. I do know that when these individuals, and I've attended many parole board hearings, when these individuals appear before the parole board after they've been in prison for an extended period of time, I spoke to an officer who worked in North Block, the lifer cell block in San Quentin. He was the captain there, and he had retired, and I spoke to him later. He was actually walking in a Safeway, and he ran into one of the men who was a lifer, and they saw each other. And he said, I was so happy to see this man who was a lifer who had gotten out. And I said, why? And he said, because, you know, I knew when you see a man in a prison or a woman, I'm sure he didn't work in a women's prison, but if you see a person in prison who's committed a murder and they've been doing this time, at a certain point, they stop saying, oh, it was because I was high, or it was because my cousin told me to. They say,
Or
it was an unfair judgment. They say, I did it. It was my fault. And he said, when you see someone take that kind of responsibility for what they have done, and it's like this transformation. And from that point on, he said, they begin to become a person that will not do it again.
What did the people who were released tell you was the most challenging part about reentering mainstream society?
You know, it's a shock to their system. They get out. The parole agent drives them out the gate. They show up at their mother's house or their brother's house. And it's the sensations of being outside in the free world that is, some of them have to just, it's overwhelming. They can't cross a street. They're terrified to cross a street. I mean, this is a real problem. But after they adjust, it's these men have been locked up their entire adult lives from the time they were 20 until now they're almost 45, 50 years old. So it's forming relationships. But then when they have had a little time, they also say getting a job is extremely difficult. Because
they've worked in prison, haven't they?
Well, they do. And some of them actually have training, sheet metal workers, they're plumbers. They learn how to do contracting, you know, construction work. But when they get out, they go, they apply and apply, and they appear before someone, and they fill out the application, and there's a, you know, don't check the box. There's a no box law where you aren't expected to ask someone to identify as someone who's done a felony. And so they go to these interviews, and everything seems to be going well, and then they'll say, oh, there's a gap here, and they'll say, where were you? I was actually serving time in a state prison for 20 years. And exactly what was that crime? And they'll say, well, it was homicide. And they say the person kind of backs away, puts the application upside down, and that's the end. So, but they don't give up. They all five men in my book, and many of the men I've followed on the outside, have jobs. They don't go back. In fact, less than 1% of those convicted of a murder in the state of California, the 1,000 that have gotten out in 21 years, zero have committed another murder, and less than 1% of any other kind of crime.
There was one particularly touching moment in the book. One of the inmates whom you profile is mesmerized by the sidewalk in front of his parents' house. He said that he'd forgotten about sidewalks while he was inside.
And pools of water, lakes, rivers, sidewalks.
Some of them have learned to program computers. I could imagine that they could get a job even if they weren't working in an office with other people doing that sort of thing.
Yes, they go to college. Two of them are in college. You know, it's interesting because two of the men in the book, lifers in California, when they're in prison, the state doesn't spend money on rehabilitation. So they have to create their own programs working with volunteers. And they created one program, it's called IMPACT, Incarcerated Men Putting Away Childish Things. And they came up with a 16-week program for becoming the men they want to be, how to have a checking account, be a father. And on the outside, two of them are now going inside the Department of Juvenile Justice, being paid by the prison system in the state to work with juveniles.
Nancy Mullane's book is called Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption. It is published by Public Affairs. And Nancy, thank you so much for being on our show, and we'll see you on the radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me.